is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll discuss a series of song story workshops. We'll also discuss street maintenance and how to pay for it. And Jessica Rosegard is back with the Advocate's Stephanie Grace to talk a bit about the upcoming mayoral race and more from this year's legislative session. Then, another story from BYO. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. Stay with us. Two community organizations have partnered to create a series of song story workshops called Freedom Chamber. Now, culminated from those series, Stand With Dignity has created a song and music video inspired by the works and words of Asada Shakur, creating context around the importance of a living wage for workers in the city. Joining me now is lead organizer for Stand With Dignity, Toya Lewis. Toya Lewis, welcome.
Hey, how y'all doing today?
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me on.
First off, tell us about Stand With Dignity.
So Stand With Dignity is a grassroots membership-based organization of structurally unemployed and underemployed Black workers organizing to get better jobs in the community. We actually take it a step further and we organize for better affordable housing as well. Mm-hmm. And we're organizing to end criminalization of Black folks.
Okay, so Freedom Chamber is continuing. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so Freedom Chamber has been the experience that Stand With Dignity has been a part of since September. Ryan and Rebecca, two amazing artists, collaborated with us to do these song and story workshops as we think through how to end mass incarceration and how to like create freedom that comes from within ourselves. We've created songs and stories through telling stories collectively.
Let's talk about the influence that Asada Shakur has had on you guys' work.
Yeah, I don't know if you noticed, but since probably 2012, we've been hearing this. It is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love each other and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains. So Stand With Dignity has picked up that quote, and that quote actually comes from a letter that Asada Shakur wrote to us, and that quote is at the end of the letter. The letter is called Letter to My People. So in the month of May in 1973 was when the New Jersey Turnpike incident happened, where Asada was shot twice mm-hmm. and accused of killing a police officer and sentenced to life in jail. She ended up spending 6 years in prison before she broke out and fled to Cuba, and she's been in exile in Cuba ever since. We know that in 2013, under President Barack Obama, she was placed on the FBI top most wanted list. And that's unfortunate, right? Mm-hmm. We would love to see her be able to come back to the United States, to be with family, to be in this movement with us, to stand
with dignity.
To stand with dignity, yeah. So in our song, we use those lyrics. It is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We use those intertwined with a lot of lyrics that we came up with ourselves, but she's been a heavy inspiration in the song.
A living wage is how we pay our bills. Stop us from going to jail and being killed. False promises, deception, and government control. Get out the way. Stop stealing our soul.
We shall speak up.
Switch.
We shall rise up.
Switch.
We shall stand up. Power up. Fighting for our people. Speak up.
Switch.
We shall rise up.
Switch.
We shall stand up. Power up.
Okay, now tell us about this event that's coming up this weekend.
So after all the long, hard, not really hard, but all the cool work of creating this music and creating this sound, we have an ending product of a music video. Well, the first product was the song that we recorded right up the street at Suno. And we want to release that to the community. But we don't just want to release the song. We also want the community to see that it's not just a song. It come from, like, the song, the lyrics, the words come from a lot of hard work we've been doing throughout the years. So there's also a teach-in.
A teach-in? Like a sit-in teach-in?
Like a sit-in teach-in.
Okay, tell us about that.
So in 2015, we worked really hard on passing two city ordinances. One is the living wage ordinance. Mm-hmm. The other is the local hire ordinance. The living wage ordinance was introduced by Jared Brousset. He allowed Stand With Dignity to sit at the table as the process of this language for this living wage ordinance went by.
Okay.
Of course, $10.55 an hour to us is not a living wage, but it's the closest thing we could get here in New Orleans. It does not reach all workers of New Orleans. It's an ordinance that only touched city contract workers. So that's any contractor that gets money from the city to do work. It raised the wages of city contract workers from $7.25 to $10.55 per hour. They also get a mandatory 7 days paid sick leave. Now, if the contractor decides not to pay 7 days of paid sick leave, they need to raise the wages to $13.72 an hour. That has not happened yet. It was supposed to go into effect January 1st, 2016.
And the ordinance was passed in 2015.
The ordinance was passed in 2015, and it was set to go into effect January 2016. But come 2017, we learned that these contractors got what the city called automatic renewals.
Okay.
So they get to automatically renew the contracts as is without adding the new amendments.
The ones that they already had.
The ones they already had.
So the ordinance only impacts those new people.
Yes, only new contracts. The problem is the city could fix this, but they are at this point refusing because they say they can't afford to.
And so all of that will be brought to light at this teach-in that's happening this weekend.
Yeah, so the teach-in is the start. We're planning to have a town hall June 13th where we want to talk to our elected officials about what it really means to enforce policies that's going to affect the people of the city. We recognize that the city's biggest priority is to end crime. However, we know, specifically at Stand With Dignity and many other organizations across the city, we know that giving police more money will not end crime. We know without a doubt that if people are able to earn living wages and have access to jobs, that will end crime. So we pushing the city to make sure that people have access to work with the local hire ordinance and have living wages on those jobs through the living wage ordinance.
All right. Well, Toya Lewis, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Toya Lewis is the lead organizer at Stand With Dignity. To say New Orleans streets are a little rough is an understatement. Now, the city has a chance to change that. Officials plan to spend nearly $2 billion over the next decade to improve the roads. But a new report says that money will be wasted if the city doesn't develop a better plan for maintaining those roads. WWNO's Tegan Wendland talked with report author Amy Glavinsky, president of the Bureau for Governmental Research.
In your new report, you estimate that 44% of our roads are in poor condition, meaning that they're full of potholes or they're largely undrivable. You even go so far as to call it deplorable. Why are our roads so bad here?
Well, I think there are a variety of reasons, but certainly one of them is that for a number of years, the city has been unable to put in place a well-funded preventive maintenance plan to take care of our streets.
Well, we have some money now to repair them, nearly $2 billion from FEMA and then from grants and bonds. But the city says it needs $5 billion to repair all the problems. So what's the plan?
So what you're speaking to is actually the number that's required for capital repair, meaning actually replacing streets. As you mentioned, the city has $2 billion coming in, and that should take them through about 8 years of reconstruction. So what our report focuses on primarily is an existing need of $30 to $35 million to properly and finally maintain our streets.
So maintenance being the most important thing here, because if we're redoing these streets but not maintaining them, we'll kind of end up back in the same position, right?
Absolutely. I think it's appropriate to view what's happening right now with the federal dollars coming in for streets as likely a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to finally get it right. So it's very important to begin maintaining all of the newly constructed roads now in a way that's sort of prudent.
And why is maintenance so important?
If the city fails to maintain its streets on an annual basis, what happens is they then slip into the more expensive capital repair category. For every dollar that's spent on maintenance now, it saves $4 to $5 in capital repairs down the road.
So if the city takes a street in your neighborhood with lots of potholes in it and just covers those potholes with patches, then in a year or two, that breaks down and they have to refill the potholes again?
So to actually sort of illustrate this problem, you can look at what happened to the city's public school facilities pre-Katrina. there was a failure to maintain them, such that many of them were in deplorable conditions, a similar adjective that we use in our report for streets. When Katrina came, there was a similar federal infusion of dollars for capital repairs to where we now have many public school facilities that that are newly rebuilt and serve our public school students really well. The important thing is that a preventive maintenance plan was put in place at the same time to preserve those federal dollars. So what we are advocating for in this report is a similar mindset, meaning if we are going to finally have these dollars to raise our streets to an acceptable level, we have to. It's incumbent upon policymakers to find dollars to likewise maintain them, or else our streets will slip into disrepair, as we've seen, as we saw happen with the public school facilities.
Is that a legal obligation or a moral one?
I think it falls into the fundamental principles of effective government.
Your report looks to solutions like street-related fees, parking tickets, and meters. Why isn't this money going towards street repairs already?
I think that's a matter of budgeting priorities. It is approximately $50 million coming in right now from street-related fees and fines. And what we found is that none of it is going towards street maintenance. And this seems to be a first logical place to look to fund these recurring needs.
So it's partly kind of about how the city makes decisions. The larger problem might be that the city's budget is far short of what it needs to be, and so we're using this traffic money for the general fund.
It's certainly an issue of competing critical needs, and we acknowledge that in our report. But I also think you have to acknowledge that finally funding a preventative maintenance plan for streets is a citizen priority, and that's part of what we have endeavored to address and offer solutions to in the report.
So you're not proposing any new taxes, but some street-related fees. What might be some other solutions to this problem?
So one solution that we came across is called a transportation utility fee, which is known as a TUF for shorthand in the field. And what this is a fee for use paid based according to a transportation engineer's report that estimates the burden a particular type of property places on the street network.
What does that mean? Like a house or a business?
It means a house or a business or a restaurant or a hospital and
however much traffic they get, essentially.
Correct. It ties the burden placed on the streets with the amount that's charged to the user. So it introduces an element of fairness into the payment structure.
So it's a small fee that business owners and citizens would pay?
Correct.
Thank you so much, Amy Glavinsky, president of the Bureau of Governmental Research.
Thank you, Tegan.
Yeah.
As Mayor Landrieu's mission to remove four Confederate monuments wrapped up last week, Landrieu's speech on the topic is making national headlines, and the New Orleans mayoral race is starting to take shape, with a fourth candidate announcing this week. WWNO's Jessica Rosegard sat down with Stephanie Grace from The Advocate to talk about the early election outlook and the next steps in relocating Confederate monuments.
I'm joined by Stephanie Grace, columnist for The Advocate. Stephanie, we've got a few things to talk about this week. Mm-hmm. Thanks for joining me.
Of course.
Let's start with the continuation of the monument issue in town. Last Friday, the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee was taken down, the fourth Confederate monument that Mayor Landrieu had proposed to remove. He gave a speech that afternoon that has really been all over my social media feed.
Mine too. It's really interesting. And it kind of took a few days to pick up, and it's still really, even if you look, you know, a week later, you see people are still saying, hey, don't miss this, read this. Mm-hmm. And people from around the country, people, writers, kind of academics. It's interesting because it really was a very eloquent speech and very moving in a lot of ways.
What really stood out for you?
Well, he really tried to put it in the broader context of his decision, how he came to the decision to pursue this, and really make a statement about how the country, the South in particular, should approach these issues. And he said, look, everybody has their own journey on race. I think the whole region has to have a journey. It was a very nuanced speech. It was clearly he worked very hard on it. And it's interesting to kind of see it take off nationally as we've had protests in Virginia, obviously South Carolina, you know, it's part of a larger story, of course.
As for the monuments, what comes next? Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser oversees the state's Department of Culture, Recreation, and Tourism, which includes the Office of State Parks and the Louisiana State Museum. Nungesser disagreed with removing the monuments in the first place, but now has been in conversations with Mayor Landrieu's office about the future of those monuments.
This process stretched out nearly 2 years. That wasn't the mayor's intent. It was held up because there were lawsuits. Mm-hmm. And during this time, there were a lot of people basically trying to say, we don't want to do this, stop this. Billy Nungesser was a very loud voice on that side. So he has now gone to the mayor and said, you know, maybe we can do something about this because I would like to display them. Mm-hmm. The mayor has said, that's great. Thank you. We've announced a process so you can participate in the process because
right.
there are other people speaking up too. So basically what the mayor has said at this point is that they're going to put out an RFP, basically a request for proposals to do something with these monuments. There are some specifications we know already. He said that it would only be open to nonprofits and government agencies. Mm-hmm. The statues would have to be displayed in context, historical context, and that historical context includes the fact that they were taken down.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot be displayed on public property in New Orleans. But we don't know, you know, we don't know the finances. We don't know a lot about this. We don't know if they'd be sold, loaned, given.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is still up in the air. I think he'd like to get this taken care of before he leaves office.
Sure.
And, you know, he does have another year. We have this strange calendar where we have the election to replace him this fall, but he's going to be in office until next May. So mm-hmm. there is some time.
Speaking of the mayoral election this fall, former municipal court judge Desiree Charbonnet announced her candidacy earlier this week. She joins City Councilwoman Latoya Cantrell, former Judge Michael Bagnaris, and businessman Michael Scurlock. How's this race shaping up?
Well, one thing that's kind of interesting at this point is that that's not that many people for a wide open race.
Right.
Mitch Landrieu, of course, is term limited. And in the past, when we've had big open races, we've had big open fields.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people want this job. It's an incredibly powerful job. You've had a number of pretty well-known political figures looking at the race. Some have spent some money. Walt Leger, a state representative, has spent quite a bit of money on research and polling and
mm-hmm.
opposition research. But some of them are very busy in the legislature where they have leadership positions, so they haven't really had time to be out campaigning. But I think if they were serious, they would be anyway. They
mm-hmm.
would be doing more. So that leaves us with an interesting field. Two of the leading candidates, and maybe even the two leading candidates
mm-hmm.
in the end of the day, are women.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, New Orleans has never had a female mayor before. And I think they're going to be talking about that a lot. These are two kind of professional young women,
mm-hmm.
and but they're very different. They're
right.
One comes from an old line political family, Desiree Charbonnet, and she's been in government most of her career. She
right.
was recorder of mortgages and then chief judge at the municipal court, which also means she hasn't been in kind of the policy side of government.
Sure, as opposed to Latoya Cantrell,
whose first job in public office was on the city council, and she really came up through kind of neighborhood organization.
Mm-hmm.
She was really involved in getting Broadmoor back after
right.
Katrina. That's kind of how she made her name and made a lot of contacts.
Judge Michael Bagnaris ran previously against Mitch Landrieu.
Correct. So he's a retired civil court judge. He goes all the way back to Dutch Morial's administration. He was a top aide to the first African-American mayor, whose son was later mayor. So that tells you how long he's been
right.
around. I know he'll talk a lot about crime. He did talk about a lot about crime last time.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody will. It's
sure.
certainly one of the top issues.
And there's a businessman in the
yes.
in the mix.
Who this is someone who has wanted to redevelop Jazzland. He's, you know, the skywriting over Jazz Fest. That's him.
Oh, I didn't
he's,
know that.
He is, yes. So he's a wild card. You know, he's not well known, but he certainly is ambitious. And Ray Nagin was someone who came from the business world and ran against, you know, very, very seasoned politicians. And I think what happened there is people looked at the seasoned politicians and
right.
said, same old, same old. What else is out there?
Stephanie Grace, columnist with The Advocate, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
And we're back with more BYO. This story was told on May 11th, 2017, at the LGBT Community Center and later produced by Lane Kaplan Levinson. The theme of the evening was Sugar in Your Tank. And here, Aaron Richmond recalls a vision in which his late aunt reveals the truth about herself. This, in turn, helps Aaron understand more about himself.
How's it go? Oh, I can't see anything. Love that. I'm in college. I'm confused about why I'm so lost and confused. So I seek out help in so many places. Traditional psychology, Jungian psychology, wasn't super helpful. And one person, I was in Western Massachusetts at the time going to college, and I sought out a witch who lives there. Some of y'all might know her. Her name is Dory Midnight. And sought her out. I was like, I'm lost. I'm confused. I don't know who I am. And she's like, okay, baby. And she gave me this tincture. It was a mugwort tincture. And I didn't know anything about magic. So she was like, I'm going to give this to you, but you need to take it. Are you listening? You need to take it in a very intentional place and time, because you will see some things and some things will be revealed to you. So I decide that the most intentional time and place to take this was in the bathroom in the middle of an economics class that I had. I thought this is an apt time for some visioning. So I go inside, I take 1, 2, 10 doses that she recommended at that time. I go inside to the class where I inevitably, I didn't do the reading, let's be real. And at that moment, I was called on to answer a question, and in my mind, I was like, I'm charming, I got this. Opened my mouth, and I just... And then suddenly, the entire classroom disintegrated. And I was walking down this, like, lush... I've never been to England, but it was dewy, and there was roses... And I just, it was like awning, awning, awning. And I just kept walking. As I got to this clearing, there was this like wrought iron white table that was like kind of overtaken by vines. And sitting there was my Aunt Deborah, who passed away in 1996. And I'm gonna give away my age, I was 5 at the time. And I looked at her and she was wearing that same 90s kind of like purple and green clown, like made out of plastic shirt that I always remembered her wearing. And she had this like really cute curly hair. She looked nothing like anybody else in my family. She was such an odd bird. And she looked at me and she said, hey, I know it's been a while. Do you have a moment? I said, well, I'm actually in class right now. And she was like, I'm dead. You're right. I'm gonna sit down. So I sat down with her, and my aunt proceeds to apologize to me for dying. And essentially, I didn't know this at the time because I was so young, but looking back on it, my aunt was the glue that kept my family together. When she passed, a lot of people turned towards alcoholism and depression in some pretty severe ways, and when she died, a little bit of money came into the family, and it was just fighting over this illusion of newly found wealth, and nobody was close anymore. So it was really this strange moment where somebody who had died, she was 35 and she had a heart attack, was apologizing to me for dying. And we kind of like, I don't know if we were having tea in my mind, maybe we were having tea. But we wrapped it up, and I walked back down this path, and she called out to me. She said, oh, Aaron, there's one other thing I have to tell you. And I turn around, and she said, yeah, it was a big old dyke. Shoot back into my economics class just crying. I don't know how long the answer had been on the tip of my tongue for a question I didn't know the answer to, but it was an embarrassing and beautiful moment. Thank you. Those are my stories.
And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Follow me on Twitter at Miss Janae Pierre, and feel free to tweet comments or questions. Would you like to suggest a guest or topic? Send an email to Janae at WWNO.org. That's J-A-N-A-E at WWNO.org. Visit our website to check out previous shows, and be sure to catch us next week right here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux-Houma.
Thanks for joining us.